Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast in which three poorly described gentlemen read science fiction and fantasy audiobooks, or listen to them, whatever.
We are humanoid-shaped.
That's inconsequential.
Mostly.
But it's not poorly described.
Okay, well, let's see. Kevin, what did we read this time?
Paradox Bound by Peter Kleins.
Yes, also known as Festival of Plosives.
And also, his name on Twitter is Peter Clown, I believe.
Yes, he has changed his name several times in the last couple of months.
Is that a reference to the Faceless Man?
I don't know.
There was one with the clown mask. Anyway.
Great. Could you give us a reading from the back of the book, please?
Indeed. Nothing ever changes in Sanders. The town's still got a video store, for God's sake. So why doesn't Eli Teague want to leave? Not that he'd ever admit it, but maybe he's been waiting for the traveler to come back. The one who's roared into his life twice before, pausing just long enough to drop tantalizing clues before disappearing in a cloud of gunfire and a squeal of tires. The one who's a walking anachronism, with her tricorn hat, flintlock rifle, and the steampunked Model A Ford. The one who's being pursued by something. So when the mysterious traveler finally reappears, Eli's determined that this time he's going to get some answers. But his hunt soon yields far more than he bargained for, plunging him headlong into a dizzying world full of competing factions and figures straight out of legend. To make sense of the mystery at his heart, he must embark on a breakneck chase across the country and through two centuries of history, with nothing less than America's past, present, and future at stake.
All right. Well, Barry, what did you think?
I really enjoyed this book quite a bit. It was just a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
Fun.
Okay. Kevin, was that your review? Just creepily saying one word again?
I like fun.
Good.
Book fun.
Good.
Can you do that same review but use the word pudding?
Pudding. Book pudding.
I'm not sure why you did that.
Barry asked me to.
To see if you would do it.
All right. I too enjoyed this book. It was a lot of fun. It's playing around with genre. It was not a lot of pudding.
You could have been eating pudding.
Thank you for using the word of the day, pudding.
Great. Okay. Yeah, did we have anything else to say before we went to our analysis section?
It has awesome time travel goodness, kind of.
Yes.
Or rather, history travel, sorry.
History travel. Yeah, they seem oddly insistent about that. I couldn't quite figure that out. It seemed like it was going to pay off somehow, but it seemed like more of just a quirk.
Well, we collectively seem to enjoy this genre of books. I don't know if it has an official name yet, but...
stuff we like.
Alt-US history, yes. Genre.
Yeah.
Alt.us.history.something.
Dot news group.
Yes. You know, good old UUCP humor.
No, the genre of books where, you know, kind of injects a bit of fantasy and or science fiction into history. And
slipstream.
That might be one way of putting it.
Yes.
Wasn't that a book with, or a movie with Mark Hamill? I don't think I ever saw it.
You're thinking of the Guyver. It's an easy mistake to make.
Oh. Okay. They both have robot hands, right?
What was that TV show where the guy, you know, travels through time and has that stupid robot that talks funny?
Knight Rider.
You're talking about
so close.
Quantum Leap.
Yes, Quantum Leap.
Oh, he has a robot?
Ziggy.
Yeah, I kept saying Quiggy or something, but that wasn't right.
Yeah, Squiggy.
Squiggy.
That was that guy from Laverne and Shirley.
Yeah. No, I've just reimagined a version of Laverne and Shirley where Lenny continually travels through time.
That would be a much more awesome show.
I immediately actually thought of Three's Company and Mr. Roper being a robot.
That would be really awesome.
Anyway, moving on.
Come and knock on my door.
I've been programmed for you.
So yeah, I'm trying to think of like a spoiler-free way to actually discuss this book. It's kind of difficult.
Yes. Given that for the attentive reader, there's actually one spoiler right there in the synopsis, even though they tried really hard to avoid it.
Tricorn hat?
Yes. The tricorn hat. That gives everything away.
It's actually the Model A Ford.
Yes.
Steampunked. I don't know. That's kind of ambiguous.
Yes. All right. So... Yes, I believe it is time for us to leave the first time around so we can return to the second iteration. That bit of gibberish may make some sense after you read the book.
I'll have a bourbon.
Exactly. We shall return, for we are sci-fi.
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 And welcome back. So, this is our discussion section, so we will spoil Paradox Bound until the paradox catches up with us and the universe is completely destroyed.
Thank Hooray God. For heat death.
So this had an unusual method of time travel. I was always assuming that she had a special time travel car, but it seemed like she just knew how to use cars to travel in time.
There's nothing magic about the car, is what she repeatedly told Eli.
She's too good for a flux capacitor.
Or a Mr. Fusion.
I mean, there's nothing magical about the car that mysteriously runs on water.
It's the Garrett yeah. carburetor.
The Garrett Duh. Carburetor. Yeah.
A real thing.
Little peek behind the scenes, folks. We had a long discussion as to the physics of how the carburetor works in the car of this book about someone who travels through time just by knowing where to skid.
Yeah, so our parts that we didn't believe was whether the carburetor was accurate. You know,
whoa. I believe it's accurate. There's a patent. I read it.
That's true. There is a patent. I'm sure there's multiple patents on
it's
water
accurate.
Power.
It just wouldn't work.
Says hey, you.
They said in the book, you just need better materials from the future.
Right. If instead of using the term water, you use the term hydrogen ashes, which is what water is.
Hydrogen ashes. Well, there's oxygen in there too, but
that's the point. That's what happens. You combine, you know, that's what happens when things burn. They combine with oxygen.
If you use hydrogen hydroxide, which sounds more chemically.
Look, I think we just all know that, you know, a monoatomic gas, like hydrogen gas by itself, is a great fuel. You just need some sort of, you know, carrier.
Right.
Oxygen.
Some kind of stabilizer.
Well, H2 is technically stable, isn't it?
Well, it's just an electrolysis device, right? And it's just that it's like a perpetual motion machine as written in the patent.
Right.
So yes, it would work if you meant we're taking water and we're converting it into hydrogen and oxygen and burning that. Yes, that would work. It just doesn't magically
It doesn't actually turn into water into a fuel source.
You need a fuel source to convert the water into a combustible medium, basically.
I mean, you're starting out with water, and then you separate the hydrogen and the oxygen, and then you burn it, which means you combine it with oxygen, so you've now...
You get water vapor at the end.
You get water vapor, so then you wiggle the tail.
And like Scotty says in one of the Star Trek movies, the thing's got to have a tailpipe, right? We have all this gaseous exploration equipment. Why don't we hook up a good old plasma detector?
Maybe it works if it's superconducting.
Why?
In the future.
Why don't you just say it's quantum and just
it's
be done with
quantum
it?
Effects. That's probably how
that's
it works.
What's happening? Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, it's completely unbelievable that the Romulans would have like a, you know, a singularity, you know, the center of their engine core. Oh, wait, we're trying that too, aren't we?
It seems like it would work. But it might have bad side effects if you didn't do it right.
track of where the hell you guys are.
It was a few crossovers and probably.
Okay. So, yeah, we've.
Ping-ponging through the multiverse.
Yes. Among the other nitpicks I had was, well, if they can. I'm willing to believe this is totally believable that go through time.
These are not criticisms. We are mostly making fun of ourselves.
Yes. I'm willing to believe you can skid through history if you know where to skid through.
Because, I know you're willing to believe that.
Because you could you just do like a little glide through some, you know, patch and it just, you know, you move through time or history. But on a train, there are tracks, right? How do you do that? You can't skid on a train. I mean, you could like suddenly accelerate, I guess, right at a certain point. But as they pointed out, it's difficult to change, you know, the speed because you have a lot of momentum in a train. So
are you saying you haven't power slid a train underneath a truck?
I have not yet done that myself.
Also, wouldn't he be like noticed by railroad authorities?
Yeah, I was also thinking like with a car, you can go around and not get hit, right? But with a train, you have to worry about train schedules. Now, it's true, he probably has train schedules for all of history, but there's probably a few trains that are off thing and you're like, oop, head on, bad collision. You know, I really hope there's a slick spot before that train hits me head on, you know?
I actually thought that it would have been better off if they had just, you know, gotten themselves some, you know, American Steel bicycles. Then that's no true. One would ever notice. And, you know, you could power slide a bike really easy.
That's much more awesome, actually. In fact, what if you just ran and just sort of like slid, like, and there's nothing more American than in baseball, right? So you could just slide across the slick spot.
You just have like little steel plates in your shoes.
They didn't say it had to be steel. Well, she did say American steel, but was the steel the magic part of it?
Or is it the American part?
Yeah. That he did ask, what's his name before he took him to get converted to a faceless man? You're an American citizen, right? This is important.
That's right. You know, it's not like modern cars where it's, you know, all the parts are made in other parts of the world and then they're just assembled finally here.
Yeah.
Right. And that way they could say, this was made in America as I wag my fingers through the air.
Technically, all the elements were made in distant stars. So.
But eventually it was assembled in America.
Okay.
After a supernova constructed the steel.
Is this why I call my car Stardust?
Do you call it Stardust?
I do now.
It's not an American car, though.
It was assembled in America.
All right. So the MacGuffin in this is literally the American dream. It was.
Don't make light of the American dream.
Wasn't that what the American dream actually looked like? Just light?
Well, yeah, but don't make light of it.
Okay. I won't make things into what they are.
Kind of like a Mobius strip and a bunch of other stuff, depending on how it twisted in its higher dimensional state.
Great. Okay.
I could somehow imagine Peter, the author, just holding his head in absolute agony as he listens to this right now. Either that or just laughing on the floor.
He's probably just like, did they read my book?
No, it'll be, this is the best review of my book ever.
They truly saw inside my soul when they were arguing about carburetors and exactly the mechanics of traveling through time on a train.
He's like,
through history.
I was going to rhetorically ask, like, what have I done? But clearly this is amazing.
So, yes. Okay. So there were places stuck in time. And actually, I thought that that was in some ways an interesting way of solving the science fiction version of the celebrity paradox, which is, how do you have your characters be sort of relatively up-to-date Americans, but not have them, you know, be spouting out science fiction references every 5 minutes. I mean, you know, if somebody showed up in a car and, you know, whisked me away for a time travel adventure, I would have at least mentioned Back to the Future, and I would certainly have mentioned Doctor Who.
They'd allude to that, but...
Well, but our main character never did. Eli.
Oh, right, right. And I see what you're saying. Because he was in Sanders, and Sanders was
sort of
kind of slowed down in time. He wasn't...
And so he wasn't necessarily catching the references or throwing the references the same way that, you know...
Everybody else was.
Well, I don't know. We would. I'm not sure about everybody.
I'm just like everybody else.
Yeah, but that's because you've cloned yourself 500 times.
Just 500?
That we know of.
Well, you yourself have cloned yourself 500 times. Each clone, of course, also cloned their own cloning machine. It's a long story.
It's the dots on the eyelid.
Yes.
I can't see. There's too many dots.
It's all dots all the way down.
Yes. So I thought that Places Stuck in Time was a clever way of dealing with that sort of thing.
Yeah, and it kind of made sense because the whole thing, like, you drive through a place, you're like, oh, that's like a place from the 1950s. You know, they're still kind of like that. And it's like, oh, no, it really is the 1950s.
But yet they have a video store.
Well, it's supposed to be 1988, right?
More or less, yeah.
So it's like Stranger Things.
So awesome then.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. And
I am still terrified of the Upside Down.
Don't you want to live there?
So this was a universe with a single timeline, as best I understood it, right? In other words, you never successfully got any paradoxes.
There is no forking. There are only predestination paradoxes or something. Or,
right.
You know, the loop is part of the thing.
Right. Closed time-like curve.
Exactly. So, yes, there are no parallel or forking timelines, as far as I could tell.
Right. I love good science fiction that involves time travel, especially if they involve sort of predestination paradoxes like that. And so I knew that Eli was going to wind up being sort of the bum that he described in the beginning, because there hadn't been anybody else mentioned that it could be. So it had to be him.
Yeah. And also I reread it, and and realize in the first paragraph as a kid, he's like throwing rocks at this rusty car.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you don't pick up on that the first time through usually, because they don't really discuss the significance until much later on. But it is kind of amusing that all these things are set out like in the first page or two.
Well, and it was sort of interesting. They have the Founders Building. I forget what it's called.
Right. Yeah.
And I remember thinking, okay, that's going to pay off later on. And it did, but I had completely forgotten about it in the interim.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these elements are introduced so early in the book, they're just sort of hiding in plain sight.
Mm-hmm.
Like you just, you know, blow right past him, just like, oh, he's just setting the tone of the, you know, of Sanders, the town that that Eli lives in with his friends and the bully.
Right.
You know, that's their sort of their nemesis.
Yeah. I was actually expecting something to change with that, because the way it was worded, you know, she's like, oh, did you get in a fight or something? And he's like, well, he threw a rock in my head. And the way it was worded, I interpreted that as, oh, this time around, you know, you didn't actually fight back or something like that. Next time you will. And like, I also was misinterpreting the whole, you know, first time around, second iteration as actually being some kind of like time loop thing that was going to happen in the book, not these places.
Right. Yeah, I was half expecting them to redo the entire book again with some slightly changed thing. And I'm kind of glad that didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, it could have gone a lot of ways. I thought this had some unique time travel bits that I hadn't seen in exactly this way. So I thought it was interesting that, you know, number one, time travel just can happen without some special equipment. You just have to kind of quote like, well, you just learn how.
You sort of feel your way through it.
Yeah. You know, I did like the stuck in time stuff, you know, the paradox stuff. And I also liked, so the Faceless Men, I thought they were very effective bad guys, I guess. You know, they were very creepy to sort of imagine them like, you know, no face. And then like they had those like plastic Halloween masks that were transparent that were just like made it extra creepy.
Right. And so they existed in certainty. And I was reminded of the Philip K. Dick story, The Golden Man.
Oh, right. That was a good one.
Where, you know, basically there was this mutant that could tell, you know, precisely what was going to happen in time and, you know, always knew which way to dodge. It was made into a basically unrelated movie. I forget.
As usual.
Yeah.
Yeah, this one, I don't think they could tell the future and the branching like that, but it was definitely like they were certain of everything, you know, the absolute, you know, values of everything within 300 foot radius or something like that, approximately.
Right. And if you shot at them, then they would just sort of like turn so that the bullet would bounce off of them, even though it did strike them.
Yeah. Right. Sort of like the perfect, you know, what is it, like an oblique angle or something.
Right.
It just caused, you know, very little damage and so it was very, very difficult to kill them. I guess the protagonist agents had managed to kill a couple of them using, I guess, sniper rifles or something.
Right.
Right, sort of the first guy who figured out, you know, what range that they were certain and that kind of stuff. And,
right.
And, I thought that was a very effective bad guy.
The only thing that confused me was how they sort of swapped to become the protagonists at the end.
Well, I think they were kind of saying, like, they were always supposed to be the protagonists, and their purpose kind of got infected by the searcher who kind of became one. I thought that was interesting because they were kind of probably purposely left it ambiguous whether he was taken and converted, you know, against his will to be a faceless man, or whether did he volunteer and to become.
Was that her husband?
No. It was someone down the line, which I kind of.
It was the guy who set up the towns originally. Abraham, I thought his name.
Abraham Porter.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the guy who set up Hourglass's.
The three bars.
Yeah, and he was in the chain,
Utah.
Right?
Right.
Yeah, he was like the second person in the chain or the first person. I don't remember. It was pretty early on.
It wasn't first. He was like 2 to 4 somewhere in there. I forget. But yeah, so that was kind of made ambiguous of like, well, you know, if this series continues in some way, maybe we'll see that. But it was like, you know, did he, because they always said he was described as somebody that would get something, you know, do what needed to be done and wasn't really just like friendly to people about stuff. He would just do stuff and like he made a lot of enemies that way. So it's like, did he become a faceless man so he could find out where it was or try to help the situation, or did they forcibly, you know, pull him off? Because they said after he became a faceless man, suddenly the faceless man's purpose shifted from looking for it to hunting down all the other searchers and killing them, basically.
Right. Well, and the only reason that the dream became lost was that the searchers believed that it was lost.
Right. So that was like, you know, that was one of those weird, you know,
like a predestination thing.
It was like the All Good Things, you know, last TNG episodes thing where it's like, okay, we are looking for it. Therefore, it, you know, like you said, it's like, you know, this is a dream that it has and people are nearby, and especially the Faceless Men who are always near it.
Right.
You know, are like, we're looking for this and now it's gone. And like, it just says, okay, well, you want to look for me, I'll just disappear. And like, so that was an interesting way to deal with that.
Yeah, the fact that the American dream hadn't actually been stolen,
right,
or anything, but it was more along the lines of
it was cloaking itself, kind of.
It seems rather like a metaphor.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's essentially hiding in plain sight because it senses that people believe that it's not there anymore, mm-hmm. right, and so therefore, you know, it feels like it needs to be true. So, oop, you know, I'm gone.
Right. Yeah. Well, so also, like, you know, we see right at the end, you know, we're kind of led here. Eli first says, okay, I know where the dream is. It's in my hometown, blah, 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 you know. And she's like, yeah, right, you know. And he's like, oh, no, it's like, you know, it's obviously not, you know, based on these things, we're not stuck in time because it's great. Everyone wants to leave and it's going really slowly. So it must be the dream is making stuff go slowly. So then, yeah, that's when they go back. They find the founder's house. And then he goes, oh, crap, this isn't where the dream is. This is where the, you know, the headquarters is of the Faceless Men. So, you know, the chase ensues. Then, you know, they kind of jump straight to the bit where, you know, he generates the rusty car that he's going to see as a kid, essentially by standing in just the right spot and waiting for the car to like get stuck between the trees or whatever.
Being driven by the hometown sheriff.
Yeah,
you know, slash bully Zero.
Yes. And so, yeah, I don't know. I thought it was interesting.
Great. Okay. So in terms of favorite scenes.
Well, there was a scene where they sort of created the dream and, you know, they go to the founding fathers who say, well, we need to convince everybody to actually, because they said this was kind of like a unique thing that had never happened, that a colony was like, well, we should be our own country. Screw you. You know, everyone, that had never happened before. And so they're like, well, in order to convince everybody, we need to make this magical dream that will make people want to do this. And so, you know, they're like, well, basically because, you know, all the founding fathers were.
I mean, they didn't just consider hiring a bunch of Russian hackers to take over Facebook.
In the future, yes. But.
Well, in the past, it would have been MySpace, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, God. Being like secret society members, they had access to these Freemasons, right? Yeah, so they're like, we had access to these like magical books, and we knew how to summon Egyptian gods of creation and so forth. So so we did that, you know. So that was kind of an interesting scene. But then the part I thought was funny was where he's like, this can't be true. And Harry's like, well, yeah, if it were true, there'd be visible signs like obelisks in the capital or pyramids on our currency.
Yeah.
So now I believe it is true.
Well, that makes it so. Barry, did you have a favorite scene?
I think if I had to pick one, I think it would be the scene when Eli first goes to the three bars in Utah, I believe. Mm-hmm. You know, there's what the was it the first time around?
Right.
The second iteration and the last paradox,
right,
which are the three bars. And, you know, they sort of had developed a set of rules about the order in which you visit the bars. But, you know, Harry immediately takes him to
the second
paradox. And he hadn't been to the first one yet because
he's new,
but he's supposed to go to that first one first. You know, and everybody's kind of like giving him the eye and they're, you know, and thinking they'd already met him.
Exactly. Hey, good to see you, man.
And so the funny thing there is that they're all the agents there assume that they've all met each other if they're at the second or third bar, because everybody is supposed to have been at the first bar at some point.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, like, but in actual their linear time, you haven't potentially met everybody yet, 'cause you may not have been to the first bar. There's like this weird.
Right. And this was also a sort of a protective thing, because I didn't really fully understand the explanation, but just because there were so many of them together that their causality was so important to that area that they would interrupt history.
Right.
Yeah, they said basically, you know, all of their timelines were intermingled with each other across different parts of the search, and also the people that actually lived there that interact with them. And so they said, you know, if they came in and tried to kill everybody, that would just like send lots of ripples through history. And like,
right. I mean, it kind of reminded me a bit later in the book of, you know, the Founder's House, where all the faceless men are sort of, it's sort of like a superposition nexus of all the faceless men, you know, through history, right? They're all sort of milling around and like kind of just, you know, walking around each other. And, you know, of course, you know, Zero slash Zeke, you know, sort of has like that incident of where he gets bumped into by another agent, which actually turns out to be right. himself from the future.
Yeah, that's my favorite scene is, you see the same sequence several different ways. So first he's being wheeled in to be turned into a faceless man, and one of them bumps into him and he yells at him. Then, you know, later on, he's the
face. Didn't you see me?
Yeah, exactly. Later on, he's the faceless man who, it bumps into him. And then later on, it's, you know, that same scene is our hero is trying to sneak through the place.
And they observe that from yet another frame of reference.
Exactly.
But also they don't really explicitly point this out, but when Zeke was being wheeled in the wheelchair, the guy wheeling him in was the clown face, faceless man, which was him even later on.
Right.
Yeah.
So there were sort of three versions of him like in different periods of time. Yeah, actually, I thought that was another interesting, you know, bit of, you know, time travel thing in here was that the fact that the headquarters was sort of the superposition, like you said, that that happened, like he said, it's always now. So it's like, you know, even though there's only 47 faceless men, there's like thousands of them in this big warehouse because, you know, so there's enough space for them to kind of go through all of their, you know, cases and everything throughout all time, basically.
Right. And sort of towards the edge of the Founder's House, you know, things started to kind of break down a bit and like sort of new events were sort of, you know, slowly creeping in there. It seemed like I thought that was a really just sort of very inventive way to do, you know, time travel slash, you know, superpositioning and things like that. I'm a big fan of, you know, superpositioning, you know, paradoxes and.
Right.
Yeah. I thought it was, I was thinking about that too. I was thinking like, well, if everything's always now, you know, how long of a kind of a loop is it? Because if everything happens at once, there has to be some amount of time roughly that, you know, you can linearly go through. You know, it must be however long one particular agent stays there at one time or something, or I don't know what it would be, but
I mean, it could be the exact amount of time it took for them to walk through the place.
Well, because I was thinking that too, or not that specific thought, but that they were always walking, sneaking through at the same time that everybody else is in there, and they, you know, they had taken that badge to kind of hide.
So, you know, when he was living there in the town, he was also always sneaking through there.
Right. And yeah, I mean, I thought it too is interesting that, you know, it kind of to add to the whole list of paradox things where it's like, it's been stolen, you know, where is it? And then she's just like, we're going to go steal it, you know? So I thought that was like a clever way to do it, but then of course it didn't actually turn out like you thought.
Which was a double twist on me because I had sort of leaped on the idea of, okay, we're going to have to, you know, we're going to have to steal it. And I thought, okay, that was obvious from the beginning. It's a time travel thing. So of course the people looking for it are just going to wind up stealing it because that's the most efficient way of doing it.
Right.
Just like, you know, the most efficient way, if you have a time machine of solving a weird missing person case is to kidnap that person. Ta-da, here they are.
That's good that you said that. Yes. But yes, from a logical point of view, sort of like from the logical robots that, you know, do things, the way to make everybody happy is to make sure they have smiles on their faces.
You're
like,
exactly.
That's not what it means. Well, you know, it's an indicator. Like, everybody smile.
It's the only metric that I have.
Yeah.
I have saved him from being kidnapped by grabbing him, putting him into my time machine and bringing him to now.
Well, so the other thing is, you know, they go a little bit and I can't say there's like always a good solution for this, but it's like, you know, when they have the town, right, with the three bars. And so, you know, he kind of says the standard thing that everyone thinks that's reading is like, well, why don't you just go to the last paradox and say, hey, where is it?
Right.
You know, and then she gives this answer that's not that satisfying, but, you know, there is no satisfying answer, but, you know, really where she's like, well, what if you go there and you're not there? And he's like, what? He's like, you know, like me, you know, implied maybe you're dead. Like, oh yeah.
Right.
And it's like, well,
okay,
let's just go there anyway.
Yeah.
You know, we could still find out. Right. And so my, you know, thought is always like, well, basically it's like, well, cause it's the rules, we don't do that. And it's like, well, screw it. Why don't you just do it anyway? It's like, yeah, that would like maybe mess up the plot of the book, but you know.
Well, and tipping their hand a little bit, there was a night watchman called Blinovich, which is a Doctor Who reference so obscure that Kevin didn't get it.
Yes. And well, also I realized when
that shocks me.
Well, the second listen through, I realized I'd missed even the plain sight one where the first time around doors are painted bright blue and someone wrote police box over the top of the front doors. And somehow I like blinked, my ears blinked and I missed that line or something the first time. But I did think it was interesting that even after she's like, oh, you can't do that. She's like, okay, I just remembered this thing. At least they said she remembered it afterwards and not like, I'm leading you in this thing that she's like, okay, you have to go over to the first one. Cause I remember seeing you there now.
Right. Right. She remembers during her wedding at the first time around that she actually saw Eli speaking with her new husband at the time.
Right.
You know, they had just been married, you know, out of the corner of her eye. And she's like, well, now you have to get your ass over there. Right. So
here's some money. Go drink over there.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Let's see. Usual questions. Was there tea? Only if you consider tea to be bourbon.
Some or days coffee. Do. It is Kentucky tea, right?
Exactly.
Kentucky tea.
What character would you want to be and or would you be? Well, there was sort of the hot female detective. She seemed pretty cool.
You mean Harriet Pritchard?
No. The detective. I don't think we learned her name.
I think Eli first runs into her at the first time around.
Her. Yeah.
She kind of like hits on him a little bit and he's like, trying to like get this, you know, whatever it is he's supposed to be doing, they're done. And she's like, well, you know, I'll see you at the second iteration.
He's like, I already did. Anyway, yeah.
He's like, yeah, about that. I think I'd like to be the faceless men.
Of course you would.
I guess that.
I think it was like a little unfair to characterize them as the antagonists of this book. I mean, they're not bad people. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing.
Well, by definition.
Right. Yeah. They were a little bit overzealous maybe, but yeah, I think.
I mean, it kind of falls in that vein of like, you know, Section 31 in the Star Trek universe or something where, you know, the goals always justify the means and.
Right. I think at the end of the book, they kind of become, they become restored to be protagonists, right. You know, that they're like, okay, we've kind of dialed back the killing everybody part, and now we're just protecting it again, which is what we should have been doing the whole time. Like,
yeah, I mean, when they started killing searchers, you know, to me it sort of seemed like an act of, you know, desperation or something.
Right. Well, it did. I mean, I was thinking that one interpretation of that would be like they didn't happen until after the searcher goes back, right? So he's like, well, what needs to be done is, you know, either a, you know, somehow he knows about that it's just vanished, that it's still there. So he's like, in order to stop that from happening, if we kill all the searchers, then nobody will be wanting to be looking for it anymore.
I mean, it's the same thing. Like when people say, you know, how do you stop elephant abuse? Well, you kill all the elephants and therefore you can't abuse elephants.
Do people really say that?
Future robot.
By people, do you mean you? Repeatedly.
I've heard at least one other person in my life say that.
Ah.
It was not a cloning.
Well, it was actually Steven just now.
See, another predestination paradox.
Exactly. Validated.
All right. Was there anything else we wanted to discuss?
Transparent aluminum.
Okay.
We don't need to discuss that really, but they did mention that.
Okay.
Without explaining it. So I guess we could do the same. Ha ha.
Or even the, I went back in time and met, you know, my grandfather or my great grandfather. Yeah. It's
grandfather paradox.
Yes.
Well, they did say that one of the Gold Rush guys in the book was the author's great-great-grandfather, you know, at the ending, right?
Oh, okay, yes. Oh, yeah, the epilogue was sort of interesting because
Henry Frank Hawkins was supposed to be his great-great-grandfather.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the end of the book was quite interesting because the author was reflecting on, you know, recent political events and how this might be seen as way too starry-eyed optimistic right now.
Yeah, he's like, before that, I was thinking some of this stuff was a little too dark, but
yeah, this just made this, you know, the current political climate has made this book fun.
As we said.
All right, well, I believe it is time for us to go visit the last paradox and see if any of us are there.
I've got my bourbon.
Barry has his clown mask on.
Yes,
Barry,
I do.
Barry with the clown mask.
It was actually always underneath my skin.
The most odd thing for me, not the most odd, but just
okay,
an odd
we're
thing.
Not done.
Yeah, I know. This is my job too, is to jump right in at the last second.
Good.
why was there so much repetition of, remember there's this guy named James Dean? He did stuff. I'm like, well, is he really that obscure? Because I'm not even that big of a James Dean fan, but I knew about a lot of stuff about him. So.
I mean, the second one was in the afterword. Yes, there really was an actor named James Dean.
Well, maybe it's because I've seen his mural on the Brookdale Lodge many times, but I think that's gone now.
The Brookdale Lodge?
Yes. In Brookdale. I mean,
I've been to the spot in the highway where supposedly the crash occurred. That's just about an hour east of
supposedly,
San Luis Obispo.
Unless he faked his own death.
Exactly.
They transported him out at the end.
Right, exactly. All right. Well, I believe it's time for us to go visit the last paradox.
Again.
I have my bourbon.
I've got my coffee. What
indeed.
Do you got? All right. Until next time, we are Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.